How do I know if I'm making spiritual progress? Ever asked that question? How do I know if I am living by faith? What are the fruits of it? Well, as we come to the scriptures, we know as we study the life of Abraham, we are studying the prototypical man of faith. The prototype, the one who's set forth more than anyone else in the New Testament as the man who shows us what living by faith was like. Now, last time we saw that he was contrasted with Lot. Remember, Lot looked. Lot saw and Lot followed his eyes. He lived by sight. And he chose the plain to live on by Sodom and Gomorrah. And he pitched his tent towards Sodom and ended up living in Sodom. He's the man who lived by sight. And we see Abraham choosing faith, trusting God. And we see in the intervening time between chapter 13 and 14, because Abraham was living by faith, he was growing in his faith. And there were fruits of his faith. So you might say, well, why should I live by faith now? Nothing's happening. God's not asking me to do anything particular. Well, maybe it's that time when you're going to grow in faith, and when the trial comes and the challenge comes, then the fruits of faith will be seen. And in the passage we see today, there are three men who come and speak to Abraham. And each time a man comes, we see a fruit of Abraham's faith shown before us. So we'll look at these people in turn. And the first one is found in verse 13. So we have this disaster falls. One who escapes came and told Abraham the Hebrew, who lived by the oaks of Mamre, and he hears, verse 14, his kinsman had been taken captive. So what's the response of Abraham to hearing Lot being taken captive? Well, we could say lots of things, fruits of faith. We could have had courage, but the one I believe we should focus on this morning is steadfast love. That character quality of God. Abraham showed steadfast love. You see, what we see in this section with Abraham as he sets off to join battle is he goes after a backslider who's getting his just deserts. But Abraham shows steadfast love. Well, let's first think here, as we consider Abraham's steadfast love, of the appeal to one is only, it's got to be on the basis of steadfast love. It's not on the basis of much more. You see, when you read verses 1 to 11, you may have been thinking, if I'd have said to you as you came in this morning, could you do the reading for this morning? And you might have said yes, and then I could have said, well, it's Genesis 14. And then you might have said, no. What are all these list of names doing? Well, it's showing the historical accuracy of the Bible. They're pulling out some source, and we could spend time going through where these kings are from. Some of them coming all the way round from where Abraham was coming from, probably the king of Elam. But in essence, what's going on? Well, what causes war? What causes war in Ukraine? Ukraine is not a barren desert. What do we find? Do we find agricultural lands? Do we find minerals? Do we find factories? Yes, we do. In those days, these kings, what did they have? They had these bitumen pits. And so if they want to build, that's very useful for asphalt. So they're going for wealth. You can see there in verse 4, this king, Chered Oleoma, has them in subjection for 12 years. So 12 years, they turn up and they say, we'll pay up. Year 13, they say, we're fed up with paying up. Why should you take our stuff? And then in year 14, Chered Oleoma comes to say, this is why you've got to give me your stuff, because if you don't, I'm going to come and I'm going to defeat you in battle. That's what is going on. So, there's the world's war for wealth. And what's happened to Lot? Lot's followed the way of the world, and because he's followed the world's ways, he's got caught up in the world's wars. And what was the prize that Lot had? Well, he had the plane. Well, had he got it anymore? No, he hadn't, because he was gone. There's no indication, is there, that Lot fought himself. Verse 12 maybe suggests that he didn't bother to go out to battle. They took Lot, the son of Abraham's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, and went away. He might not have joined battle, but it doesn't matter. He's in the wrong place. And so the people appearing to Abraham are not saying, well, yeah, Lot's done really well. No, it's got to be on the basis of something deeper. But let's think further. Why is Abraham able to show steadfast love? Why, on hearing this appeal, your nephew Lot, your kinsman, is in trouble, why is he able to help? Well, that's because of what we saw last time of Abraham's stand on separation. He was going to live a separated life. He was in the world, but he was not of it. It's not he didn't know people from the world. He had allies. People knew him. He was a public figure. But what was his strength? His strength was not being in Sodom. That's why they could come to him. And he's receiving a reward in one sense. He's not been caught up in this. Therefore, he's able to help. Now, he could take the high line, couldn't he? He could say, well, hang on a second. I have done the right thing. Lot, that fool, has not only chosen the best land greedily, he's then gone and lived in Sodom. And what has Providence shown? Providence has shown that I got it right and he got it wrong. And he could have shrugged his shoulders and said, well, I gave him the choice. I said choose. He chose. He got it coming to him. He could have said, is this not God's judgment on Lot for making a wrong choice? But faith did make him independent because he was separate, but it didn't make him indifferent. And that's important to understand as we think about separation, separation from the world, and even separation from worldly believers who get caught up in the world. We might be independent, but we're not indifferent. It's not that we don't care, because faith follows God's quality of steadfast love, and he cares. So when he has the appeal, he has the ability, and that ability translates to action. Now, we don't usually think, do we, of Abraham as a kind of a warrior. I mean, if this was David, wasn't it? Remember, David got in trouble at once when he went out to fight. He found his camp raided and off he went in pursuit. We wouldn't really pause, would we, in reading the Bible to see David off in pursuit. Well, that was David. That's what he did. Even someone like Gideon, you think, well, the time of the Judges, that was a kind of ruthless time. Armies going here and there. But suddenly with Abraham, it's a bit of a jolt, isn't it? Abraham is almost like some form of chieftain. I mean, look at how many men he's got. 318 trained men. When we think about Abraham, we're not thinking about a man in a tent on his own. You know, you think up on a hillside, there's a lonely tent, we wouldn't spot him. There's a sizable encampment, isn't there? He's got a number of men who are following his lead. And no doubt being blessed, because in him shall all the nations be blessed. I'll bless those who bless you. And the text may be telling us something when it says in verse 14, he went in pursuit as far as Dan. What would it be saying there? What do we know about Dan? Well, Dan is the northernmost tribe. What's God promised him? He's promised him the land. And so basically, if these people come into the promised land, they're into the land that's been promised to Abraham. They shouldn't be there. And Abraham is going to chase them out and he's going to take back what they shouldn't have taken. So this is hinting at the land promise that he is depending on as he goes off in pursuit. We see him there, verse 15, divides his forces against them by night, he and his servants, defeated them and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus. He's taken them right out of the land. And he brought back the possession. So very successful military operation hits them at night. Very confusing. There's no torches as we would have in modern days. And back he comes. So what are we to make of this today? Because it's not normal for us to hear someone else has been taken captive and please take your 318 men in pursuit. But what is Lot in his essence? Well, Lot is a backslider. And this text encourages us to ask this question of ourselves. How do I respond when I hear that a fellow believer, maybe even a fellow church member, sins? Do I think, well, serves them right? Do I think, well, they reap what they sow? You sow to the flesh, of the flesh you will reap corruption. Or is my heart like the heart of Abraham, that by faith has worked steadfast love because the character qualities of God are worked in his people, and Abraham's steadfast love meant he was willing to go out at risk to himself to clean up the mess that someone else has got themselves into? And don't people get themselves into messes following Lot today? Sometimes because of the area that they move to. They move to an area they've not thought about their soul and the church. The job that they take, they're just looking for promotion and betterment, and they've not thought about the compromises or again the area. Or the person they've married, they're just so desperate to get married, they're just like, I've waited long enough, and they suddenly find that the person they married, they looked like a Christian, but time showed that they weren't a Christian, and suddenly they're in a mess. Or there's a multitude of decisions that people make. When that goes on, what's our attitude to another believer? Do we say, oh, they're a fool? Or do we have steadfast love? Our heart goes out for them, like Abraham's heart. But we could go further on this. And we could say, how do we respond when other believers or others call us to spiritual battle? Because you notice in this text, it's not that Lot appeals for help. There's no sense, is there, that Lot has got a message to Abraham, is there? He's not seen these kings coming and said, Abraham, help. I'm in a place where the kings have rebelled. We've got problems. Lot's not turned up and said, Abraham, can we sort this out? Can we be together? Someone else has come and said for help. And it may be that someone comes and tells us about a backslider. And they've gone into the world as if the world's now got them captive. And what do we do then? They might say, can you battle with me for them? Principally, that would be in prayer, because only God can spring people out. But it may be going to them and appealing to them. And that may be difficult. But living by faith meant that Abraham had this heart that when someone appealed to him on the basis of his steadfast love, he was willing to act. That's the first quality we see worked in Abraham. But there's a second quality here, and it's seen as we come and look at the two men who come to meet him on his return. Look at verse 17 with me. He comes back. He's got his kinsmen, he's got Lot, he's got his possessions, he's got the women and the people. Verse 17, after Abraham's return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now, who speaks first? King of Sodom's mentioned as coming out first, and then Melchizedek, but who speaks first? It's Melchizedek. So we'll consider Melchizedek first, and it's significant the order in which they speak, particularly given the order they come out and they're mentioned. We see in his meeting with Melchizedek that God has worked in Abraham, who is the centre of God's promise, the quality of humility. You see, in this great moment of victory, Abraham recognised that Melchizedek had a relationship with God that he lacked and needed to benefit from. Melchizedek had a relationship with God that he lacked and needed to benefit from. Now, I was at a meeting yesterday, and I said what I was speaking on this morning, and I was speaking on Melchizedek, and someone smiled and basically like, well, Melchizedek, I mean, who is Melchizedek? You might be saying, well, who is this man who turns up? Well, it says he's king of Salem, Jerusalem, but Salem, if you think about Hebrew's got the letters S-L-M, Shalom, king of peace. His name means king of righteousness. So the Melk is the king and the Zedek is the righteousness. So we know he's a king, text tells us, of righteousness and peace. He's the priest of God's Most High. And if we were to turn to our best commentary, which is found in Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 7. We've looked at Hebrews before, so we're not so much looking at the points made from there today, but we're looking at the infallible interpretation of the Old Testament found in the New Testament, the best commentary you can ever read on Genesis, found here. He's superior. Hebrews 7:7 says, it is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. And that's in the context of Melchizedek. It also points out in Hebrews 7 verse 3 that he, Melchizedek, is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. So the writer to the Hebrews, when they talk about Melchizedek, says, as he is recorded in Genesis, we know nothing of his history. We know nothing of what's to come, and therefore he's there as a picture, a type of the Lord Jesus Christ, a priest king. And the book of Hebrews brings out much about that. But at the moment, I'm just asking who he was. Some people would say, well, maybe he's Shem, who lived a very long life. Well, Shem has got a very strong ancestry, so it doesn't seem it can be Shem. The best surmise seems to be that he's some descendant of Japheth. So you remember, Noah's got three sons. Ham is all the people in Canaan, and they tend to be pretty wicked men, the Canaanites. You've got the line of promise, which is the line of Shem, which is the Semitics, this is Abraham. And then you've got the Japhethites. And it could be that Melchizedek was one of those, still a believer. So, who was he? Well, we know he's a believer, he's a priest, he's a king, he's a superior to Abraham. We could speculate, but that's probably about as far as we can go. You might say then, well, how is he a priest? What does it mean to be a priest? Well, he clearly represented God to Abraham. That's what priests do. Priests don't, they stand between God and man. So, he blessed Abraham. So, he's giving a message from God to Abraham, and that's what the priests did. Remember, Aaron used to lift up his hands and say, the Lord bless you and keep you, the Lord make his face shine upon you, the Lord lift his countenance up to you and give you peace. It's part of what priests did. So Melchizedek blesses Abraham. And in the context, could it be that Melchizedek has been representing Abraham to God? Has he been performing the Moses role? When Joshua was fighting against Amalek, Moses was praying for the battle. Is that what Melchizedek's been doing? Quite possible. Doesn't say, but quite possible given his priestly role. So what does he do? It says here in verse 18, he brings out bread and wine. Now, that's not snack time. Okay? So when he brings out bread and wine, the idea is Abraham's got 318 men with him who've just been pursuing and they're hungry. And so he comes out and you've got a fellowship meal. Can you imagine what they talked about? Wow. Well, Melchizedek, what are we talking about? Melchizedek knows. He's a priest. You need sacrifices to come to God. And Melchizedek will be very, very interested in Abraham. Why? Because God's promised a curse reverser. And the line of promise is coming down the line of Shem. That's the line of blessing. And Abraham is at the center of the line of blessing. Well, Melchizedek and Abraham, it would be fascinating to see what they were talking about. Promised son, Is that going to be the curse reversal? Could it be just one generation to come? Spiritual fellowship. I mean, who else can Abraham have spiritual fellowship with? Lot's a bit of a dead loss. Beyond Sarah, maybe some people, Eliezer of Damascus, but they've got fellowship. But we see that Abraham responds with humility. I mean, Abraham could be coming up and say, hang on a second, I am it, really. I mean, I am the centre of God's purposes. I go into Egypt, I come out blessed. I take my 318 men, I recover all. I mean, I'm the man. Centre of God's purposes. What does Abraham say? No. He gives him, verse 20, a tenth, a tithe of everything. He is speaking about his need of the priest, which fits with the New Testament picture. Because the New Testament picture says that Abraham, like everyone, needed a priest. Abraham was having from his body, it says in the New Testament, the whole priestly tribe coming, but that wasn't, hadn't come yet. And there was a superior priest, Melchizedek. And the Lord Jesus Christ, Psalm 110 tells us, is a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So we see humility worked in Abraham. He's saying, I need fellowship with this man. And we need fellowship, don't we? You have that humility. Whatever our spiritual strengths are, we're in desperate need of fellowship, particularly at a high point, because we're vulnerable at a high point. Sometimes we want fellowship at a low point, but Abraham wanted fellowship at a high point. And we need a priest after the order of Melchizedek. He needed to come to God's independence. And a priest, he's the idea of, again, of Abraham's coming to him as a sinner. And so the message he's getting from Melchizedek is very clear, isn't it? Verse 19. Blessed be Abraham by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who's delivered your enemies into your hands. All the focus off Abraham onto God. Abraham, you are nothing apart from God's blessing. And every virtue we possess, and every victory won, and every thought of holiness are his alone. You may know that some of the people that you look up to most in the faith, who are mature in the faith, who are blessed, are some of the most humble people because they're closer to God. And that is the quality of faith in Abraham, looking over to Melchizedek. We could say lots more about Melchizedek when we looked at Hebrews. We looked at that in more detail. I'm happy to talk about it later, but for now, we see the humility of Abraham in meeting him. Now, final person he meets now is the king, or final person who speaks is the king of Sodom. We've seen Abraham's steadfast love, we've seen Abraham's humility, and now we see Abraham's dependence. You see, Abraham here, as he meets the king of Sodom, refused any advancement from the world. You see, it seems that the king of Sodom has been made to wait. I mean, he seemed to be out there quite fast, verse 17. The king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Sheva. That is the king's valley. And then you've got the Melchizedek interlude, where Abraham gets kind of spiritually prepared, in one sense, for what's about to happen. And now, verse 21, the king of Sodom comes to him and says, give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself. What's the king of Sodom doing there? Well, the king of Sodom, I mean, he is just at rock bottom, isn't he? He has lost everything. He's lost all his people, all his possessions, and he is just an absolute nobody. He might be a king in title, but he's got no power. And the king of Sodom is coming to Abraham. I mean, it's pretty embarrassing, isn't it? I mean, Abraham's he's this herdsman, and he's just taken 318 men and taken out all these kings. And Abraham's come back. He is the man, and he's the man locally. The kings have gone. Abraham's the man he's going to deal with. I mean, is Abraham going to say, right, okay, well, we start thinking about tribute. What's the amount we'll take each year? Well, that's what the king of Sodom would have done, isn't it? That's how kings operate. So he's trying to get in the negotiation straight away. So you don't wait for Abraham to come up with any of that. You get in with a deal. He says, okay, here we go, Abraham. I'll take the persons. You can have all the goods. Deal? King of Sodom thinks that's a good deal. I get out of this with the people, I can start rebuilding, I'm a king again, I've got people to rule, we can start from scratch. Deal, Abraham. That's, for Abraham, that's quite tempting, isn't it? All that stuff, stacks of stuff. I thought God helped him. What's he doing? He's tempting Abraham. He's tempting Abraham to get involved in worldly ways, to confuse worldly benefits with divine blessing. And this is when we see Abraham's total dependence upon God. He's absolutely resolute. You see in verse 22, he's prepared. It says, I've lifted my hand. You might have a footnote. Lifting the hand is a Hebraism for I made an oath. I took an oath to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I've made Abraham rich. I will take nothing. Abraham, this is emphatic. He's got an oath, not take a thing. I will take nothing. When's he made this oath? Has he made it in this chat to Melchizedek? Because Melchizedek talks about God's going to bless you. And Abraham said, right, I'm going to take this oath. Nothing from the king of Sodom. Abraham's seen what's happened when you get caught up with the king of Sodom. And he says, I'm having nothing to do with him. At all. There's your stuff back. I only went for Lot. People who came with me, they can have their share for their fighting that they've done, but I'm not interested in anything. And so here we find for ourselves as well our attitude to this world or the world to come. What did Abraham do? He lived, Hebrews 11 tells us, in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise, for he waited for what? A city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. His view was heaven to come. That's where he was going. He never saw the land, in one sense, as a possession. He was a nomad. And so we ask ourselves, are my thoughts like Abraham's thought? Is my dependence like Abraham's dependence? Are my thoughts and actions focused on my bank balance on earth or my treasures in heaven? Where do my thoughts go? Where does my time go? Where does my focus go? Where does my thoughts for the future go? Do I think in terms of my thoughts for my future, I need to be in obedience and dependence on God, or do I think I need to be getting on in this world? Because we're surrounded, aren't we, like Abraham was, by Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, Zeboim, Zor. There's all these worldly cities, these worldly kings, there's people going in a completely different way. But Abraham says, no, I'm going to take an oath. What does that suggest to you about Abraham? He's got the temptation to take the wealth. You don't make oaths that you won't take anything unless you're tempted to take something, do you? If you're not going to take it, I mean, you don't care. He knows his heart. So, Abraham and Lot head off. Lot realizes that he was wrong to live in Sodom, goes back and lives with Abraham, and they go to Bethel. Is that what happens? No. Do you see the tragedy? Lot, unbelievably, heads back to Sodom. He's not learnt. Off he goes. But has Abraham wasted his time? No. Because what has faith bred? Faith's bred this steadfast love, like God's, that goes out to the backslider. It's bred humility to receive a blessing from and enjoy fellowship with Melchizedek. It's bred dependence upon God. That's so necessary for Abraham in the future. He's still, he and Sarah are getting older and there's still no child on the way. So Abraham was learning to live by faith, trusting God's providence. He let Lot choose and was blessed with a meeting with God and further promises. He rescued Lot and he's blessed with fellowship with God's priest, Melchizedek, and further blessing. Abraham is just learning, I just need to do the right thing in dependence upon God and trust him for the results. And that's why it's a challenge for us, isn't it? We think, am I making spiritual progress? Do I see these fruits in me? Steadfast love, dependence, and also the humility. Now, last time we're thinking about dependence upon God, and that it ends in this way: whate'er my God ordains is right, here shall my stand be taken. Though sorrow, need, or death be mine, yet am I not forsaken. My Father's care is round me there. He holds me that I shall not fall, and so to him I leave it all. Can we say that from our hearts, as Abraham could say, he holds me that I shall not fall, and so to him I leave it all. Amen.